Hey East Meets West listeners, today Albert and I are looking at something a little left field and talking about the Australia-ASEAN Power Link, a proposed project that aims to connect renewable energy from northern Australia to Southeast Asia. The project caught our eye as a mix between traditional infrastructure but also a heavy emphasis on new tech, with the added bonus of some drama between two of Australia's richest billionaires, Fortescue Metals' Andrew Forrest and Atlassian's Michael Cannon-Brookes. This is a great episode to understand some of the challenges of the global renewable energy transition. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about understanding Asia tech and how Asia tech affects the world. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, Albert. How are you doing this week?
Dan, I'm going good. You know, something I didn't tell you before we started recording, but I just want to shout out right now, is I ran into this guy, Toby, who listens to our podcast, is a friend of a friend of ours. Ran to him at WeWork yesterday, and he was like, hey, still listening to the podcast, been thinking about you, weirdly enough. Notice you've had a bit of a shift in like what you're talking about. Very cool.
That is pretty cool, actually, Albert. It seems that everyone who's anyone and is commenting about the pod, whether it be in a Marrickville Park or at a WeWork, is coming to you rather than me, which I find a bit curious.
I think that that's two examples, Dan. I don't know whether you can speculate or draw that conclusion, but I'm happy to take it. Thank you.
Take it. I mean, I've got other people I know who are listening back home while I'm here in Indo, so shout out to them. But Albert, let's get stuck into this week's episode. We're talking about Sun Cable, the Sun Cable project, which you actually came up with the idea for this one, which is a bit interesting to me. This is obviously sort of my work in the energy transition space and infrastructure. But I'm more curious to understand, Albert, why you are a certified tech head is kind of looking towards infrastructure, particularly this project, as one that sparks your interest.
Yeah, so talking about Sun Cable, or I think specifically known as like the Australia-Asia Power Link. Sun Cable's the company behind the link itself. I think interest draws two things. First, it's a very politicized and highly like written about topic in the media. I don't actually know too much about the Sun Cable project. The second thing is, it's one of these projects in like the climate and energy space, Dan, which you're very much familiar with. But because it's in this intersection of like technology around like climate energy and renewable technology and infrastructure, because it is like a big project, there's obviously like massive hardware components to it. They're building these solar farms, they're running these cables. It's kind of positioned itself in this like unique intersection of infrastructure and technology, which I think a lot of climate investing is positioned in. So it's a pretty interesting business or like topic area to unpick, because it's a good on-ramp into climate as an asset class.
100%. So let's get stuck into, you know, what is this PowerLink project that Sun Cable is sitting behind? It's the world's sort of largest solar farm. That's how they build themselves, located about 800 kilometers south of Darwin. There's going to be a huge solar farm and a huge set of batteries as well. And the idea is that they're going to export about 17 to 20 gigawatts of energy around Australia, and then also a portion of that through an undersea cable to Singapore. So to give like a sense of the scale here, usually the projects I'd work on, which are quite large, you're dealing with maybe 1 gigawatt of energy, quite, you know, a substantive amount of energy is being produced there. But this is, you know, 17 to 20 times that. This is going to be one of the largest energy producers in the world for what it is. And there's kind of three components to it, which are just huge in scale for each individual segment. One are the solar farms itself. So it's going to be a 12,000 hectare solar farm. So thousands and thousands of panels lining up. Then you've got these huge batteries for storage. So for these renewable energies, particularly solar, obviously nothing's running during the nighttime when the sun's down. So you have to have batteries to store the energy produced during the day. And then if that wasn't all complicated enough, you're then going to have a 4,200 kilometer undersea cable to transmit all this electricity generated in Australia all the way to Singapore.
Yeah. I think Australia, and then specifically like Darwin and Northern Territory, is a very unique position in that enables them to do this. Like Darwin is not a highly dense area. There's obviously like an urban environment within Darwin, but like outside of Darwin, like we're up there, there's like a broader like land mass that has almost no population density at all. So then you can build out these large solar panels. And I think the aspiration was to build a solar farm. You could see from space, if you type in like Sun Cable into Google Images, you can see the renders of all the like solar panels that they were looking to build. Like it's a pretty crazy project that like only Australia and then only the Northern Territory was in a unique position to do.
Yeah, I mean, Australia with its land size, it is a unique spot for us. Countries in Asia like Singapore just don't have the amount of land and space available to have these huge renewable projects. But let's also look at another very quintessentially Australian aspect of this project, Albert. There's two Australian billionaires that were kind of squabbling over the rights to the project. Andrew Forrest from Fortescue Metals and then Mike Cannon-Brooks, MCB of Atlassian. So I think to give a quick rundown of the disagreement between Forrest and MCB, Forrest is really, really interested in green hydrogen, which they can potentially use instead of coal to produce a lot of the steel, which they export to China. And so what they were thinking, what they would prefer rather, is that all of this electricity you're producing in Darwin, rather than sending it overseas to Singapore, why not use it in Australia to create green hydrogen? So an interesting sort of difference there. Michael Cannon-Brooks seems to be firmly wedded towards the plan of exporting to Singapore.
Yeah. And so, you know, kind of jumping ahead now, the consortium that has actually purchased or won Sun Cable with Grok. So Grok is like MCB's investment entity, a business called Quinbrook Infrastructure Partners. They are like looking at the viability of this project and whether like it's something they prepare. They're talking about a, you know, a broader 4 to 6 month DD process. I think Dan probably good to get a sense, because I really couldn't get a sense when I was looking and doing research for this episode. Like, where's the project actually up to? Like, they obviously have, if it started in 2018, 2019, like, well, do you know how it's tracking across the number of solar panels they've laid down, things like that?
The team behind the project said that they'll begin construction in 2024 and start to deliver electricity to Darwin in 2026 and then Singapore by 2027. But there's a lot of complexity to that. I mean, the reason they're called developers is that there's sort of this planning phase associated with the development before you actually get into construction. Lots and lots of things can go wrong. And if you just look at the sticker price at which Grok and Quinbrook acquired the Sun Cable entity and the related project information and details and everything associated with it, $100 million. And we're talking about a project that's potentially worth $34 billion. The delta between those two numbers is the risk that this project just never eventuates. You know, the upside for a developer is they take on a risky project and then through their skill and expertise, they can pull it off and then they get a huge multiple because they were in on it at the ground floor. This project has got so much risk behind it that, you know, when you start looking at that timeline I just mentioned, Albert, of construction in 2024, electricity to Darwin by 2026, and then to Singapore by 2027, it means there's different phases to this. The first phase is going to be construction of just the solar plant and the batteries in Darwin. And so that's where we're up to at the moment. They're going to be trying to get a lot of financing on board, which means they have to get the economics of the project right. Underlying all of these big projects is something called a power purchase agreement, which is essentially, if we're going to build this big, you know, power plant, whatever it might be, that produces electricity, in advance, we have people sign up to buy that electricity from us at a certain price and a certain amount. That makes it really easy then for financiers to say, okay, if you create this project, then over the next 30 years, you're going to make X amount of money, which means we know how much to loan out to you to earn a return. So that's the way these projects get started, is they do the due diligence to make sure that the project is viable. They then try and convince financiers to give them money to build it, and then they build it. And that's the phase we're in at the moment, is pre-construction, trying to get the funding for it.
I think it helps that obviously Grok has deep pockets, and then Queen Infrastructure partners have deep pockets, so they can build out like a leverage model. I think if people are thinking about how these kind of financing works, obviously, like, as the owners, MCB and Quinn will put up some of their own money, and that helps them like use that as leverage for like a loan facility to then project finance the Sun Cable and the solar panels. I think what's probably more interesting of a conversation is like, if this happens, and now we're kind of speculating, but if this happens, where does this business play on the landscape across like Australia's energy assets? And then especially considering that MCB owns a pretty significant chunk of the pie when it comes to AGL, is there a potential for MCB to like bolt that on, to spin it off and to IPO it to get a bit of liquidity back? Like, it's a pretty interesting play that will have ripple effects in like the Australian climate landscape.
Yeah, there's two directions that I'm kind of monitoring to see where this one goes. One is when you look at what potentially the most risky part of this is, because, you know, people have built solar farms before, not at this scale, but they've built them before. The cable is the part which is, I think, most speculative, getting it all the way out to Singapore. So the easiest pivot would be, rather than, you know, you build your solar farm, but then rather than tag on that big pipeline, that big cable all the way up to Singapore, is you just go the other direction. You go towards the eastern states of Australia and you try and run and sell electricity to them, which there is a need for. That to me is the obvious place to go to next. But the second more interesting thing to me, particularly as we're looking at tech and the intersection here with between, you know, more traditional infrastructure and newer digital technology, what I mentioned earlier about groups buying up electricity to then sell on to consumers, that's now happening for data centers. Like, now there's actually Google, Facebook, etc. They're buying electricity directly from power plants because they need that much of it to power their huge data centers, their computers, everything else. There's a play here where, you know, in a stable region like Australia, you start setting up all these data centers powered by this project to then service consumers, users in Asia, which I find like a really interesting prospect, because when you talk about more and more data, it means more and more data centers, which means more and more electricity to power those data centers.
Yeah, I think there's like two things here. The first is like the cost of energy, and like as you start to harness other forms of energy, like what Sun Cable's doing with solar, etc., like obviously net, the cost of energy decreases because you've just got a larger supply of energy. And so it's like, one, there's like the cost of energy approaching zero. And then it's like what you can do when the marginal cost of energy is zero. Because when the marginal cost of energy is zero, in the same way that like the cost of compute is approaching zero, then you can start to do some really interesting things. And so like, I wouldn't say it's analogous, but when compute goes to zero, you can do some pretty incredible like machine learning, which you couldn't do previously because computer was so expensive. When energy approaches zero, which is, you know, obviously something that we would love to see, then you can do some pretty incredible things.
I do want to hit Albert the cable, because we've kind of tiptoed around it without really diving into the, you know, the potential and the issues with this cable. So as we mentioned, a 4,200 kilometer long undersea cable, which it's not going to send all of the electricity produced from this solar farm to Singapore. The capacity of the cable is only about 3 gigawatts, so that's what's going to be pumped out towards Singapore. But, you know, there has been the use of undersea cables across the globe. Great Britain uses 4 between it, France, Ireland, and the Netherlands to get about 5% of its electricity generation needs. So this is, you know, proven technology over shorter distances. It's the fact that this is 4,200 kilometers, which makes it really, really ambitious and intriguing. And there's two kind of problems with it. both associated with the size and the length of the cable. The first is the longer that electricity has to travel, you lose some of it along the way. This is called leakage. And estimates currently have that, you know, across a 4,200 kilometer cable, you're going to lose about 15% of the electricity that you're trying to send. The second big issue is when you're looking at the length of the cable, there's obviously problems that can come about, whether it be a puncture, a twist or a turn in the cable, which prevents electricity from flowing properly. And if you have to go and repair and maintain that cable, that's a massive undertaking. You know, a much shorter undersea cable, there was a known issue where it took about 6 months for the company to charter out, get the ship in place, find where the problem was in the cable, and then rectify that issue.
That's actually crazy.
Yeah.
I think there's probably even a precursor to that is that, you know, running a cable underwater for the length of it is, I think it's like 4,200 kilometers, right? Like, there is an unfathomable amount of things that could go wrong from, you know, the cable degrading, like in the ways you've just described, for things like earthquake. I think Andrew Blakers from the ANU was in an ABC article talking about how, you know, just even through navigate through like Indonesian waters, there's like magnetic sand that could interfere with the cable and the electricity. There's like earthquakes obviously can interfere with the cable. Like, it's a pretty crazy and monumental task to actually build a cable to run from Australia to like Singapore. And so it is like outrageous, but I think it's one of those like crazy billionaire outrageous things that you can do when you are MCB.
Just to be clear as well, the subsea route for the Sun Cable project hasn't actually been surveyed yet, or the survey hasn't been completed yet. So until that survey is complete and then reviewed and verified, not even the company could say hand on heart that they can run this cable 100%.
Yeah. Let's park this conversation, because I feel like we can go on and on and wrap it up here. I think two things it's worth noting before we wrap it up. The first is like, we do get to benefit from this. I think like one of the partners who's running Quinn was talking about how he's not just looking at how you funnel energy into Singapore. He's looking at how you funnel that back into the Australian grid, which hopefully then like reduces the cost of energy. The second thing is like, this puts Australia like firmly in the map and kind of like cements us within the region as like a major player. If we can like be the energy player, I think there's like commentary around private companies solving, you know, public interest problems, but that's like another thing. But something to think about, I think, when it comes to the climate space.
All right, Abbott, let's finish up there. Thank you for listening to the East Meets West podcast, a podcast about understanding Asia tech and how Asia tech affects the world. Thanks for listening. Subscribe and follow the pod if you're not already. And we'll catch you next week, as always. See you.